coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. 2 years after allowing girls to join their ranks, Scouts BSA has its first female Eagle Scout in the first state.
It feels really good knowing that I'm one of the people across the entire country. And to be the first in Delmarva is really amazing. To know that I'm going to be the one other people will look up to.
Our Sophia Schmidt introduces us to this groundbreaking scout. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also hear from a Delaware native and expert on Saudi Arabia about his new book on changes in that country. And we have the latest episode of the A Matter of Facts podcast, focused on Google. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. It's been just 2 years since girls were allowed into Scouts BSA, formerly known as Boy Scouts. But in that time, one Delaware girl has worked all the way through the scouting ranks to the top rank of Eagle Scout. Delaware Public Media's Sophia Schmidt has her story.
A lot of people would find camping 37 nights outside over 2 years hard, but 14-year-old Scarlett Helmecki...
By the end of the night, I kind of just want to set up a sleeping bag on a picnic bench or platform or even make a homemade shelter. Definitely fun on my part, but a lot of the other girls call me crazy.
Scarlett is one of nearly 1,000 girls from across the country in the inaugural class of female Eagle Scouts. These are the first girls in the more than 100-year history of Scouts BSA, formerly Boy Scouts, to reach the program's highest rank. And they've had just 2 years since Boy Scouts became Scouts BSA and started accepting girls to do it. Only about 6% of Scouts overall make it to the rank of Eagle. A Scout must finish 21 merit badges, covering a range of topics, from first aid to civics. They must also take on a leadership role in their troop and community. And they need to finish a large community service project, which they research and organize themselves. Scarlett's project was replacing an old telephone pole bridge at her school in Hokesson.
We got brand new telephone poles that were donated in, and then we laid new decking and... It was a lot of fun. It took us a couple days to do. I think we had about 20-plus volunteer.
Scarlett was part of Delaware's first all-girls troop, number 1923, named after the year that Delaware belatedly ratified the 19th Amendment, which gave women the right to vote.
You guys are lowering the flag.
I talked to Scarlett in spring 2019 after the brand new troop practiced raising flags.
A lot of other people in my family were scouts and grew up around hunting and doing all of those outdoorsy things. So it would be cool to know that, yeah, our grandparents did this, but now we get to do this for the first time and just leave behind a good legacy.
In the 2 years since, Scarlett and the other girls in her troop have faced teasing from male scouts and even some comments from adults, like when they would go on trips and stop at rest stops.
And there would be older people there, and a couple of them were super cool, and they started talking to us about our ranks and our journeys and how they were Boy Scouts and how they think it's amazing. But then you also have people online like, Boy Scouts is just for boys, or, well, then why can't boys be in Girl Scouts? And you already have Girl Scouts.
But Scarlett doesn't let it get to her.
I don't think anyone means so much harm, but it's just hard for people to change, and it's a lot of change.
So what was the hardest part of becoming an Eagle Scout?
I really hate paperwork. I'm not good at the paperwork.
Scarlett's mom, Shannon Helmecki, says she saw her daughter grow and mature through the process.
So rather than saying that she could do everything by herself, she really did rely on others and reach out for help, which was a huge stretch for her because she's typically one that will just take on a challenge all by herself and not ask for help.
These skills will likely help Scarlett in the future.
As an employer, if I see Eagle Scout on the resume, that matters a lot. But it's not so much the, oh, this person's an Eagle Scout, they've got the title. It's the skills that come with it and the confidence that comes with it.
Patrick Kayser is Scoutmaster of Troop 1923. He sees the historical significance of Scarlett's accomplishments.
When we hear from women involved in scouting, just the fact that this is possible means a lot for them. To see kind of this is a concrete, tangible example, there have definitely been some tears in eyes to see, you know, the first in a Delaware troop, the first in our council, to cross that final, you know, that final milestone.
Kaser says the speed at which Scarlett and the rest of the inaugural female class achieved Eagle Scout is unusual. He credits this to their sense of purpose.
So this first group of pioneers nationally, it's a different motivation behind it. And that's unique for the young women who earned Eagle nationally in this first inaugural class. The common thread really is, again, can you have for 2 years straight, keep focused, keep motivated, keep the drive going?
And in that same 2 years, Troop 1923 has nearly quadrupled in size.
Most of the growth has been friends inviting friends. That the kids are having a great time and they're inviting their friends along, you know, to come join this.
As for Scarlett, she plans to keep building her skills through the Scouts Venturing Program and help other girls along the way.
Right now, I'm leading a bunch of the younger girls and getting more rank advancement and kind of teaching them what Boy Scouts or Scouts is all about.
Scarlett says being the one that other girls can look up to feels really amazing. Sophia Schmidt, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Sophia. Next on The Green, we chat with a Delaware native, an expert on Saudi Arabia, about his new book on the changing socioeconomic landscape of that country. Stay with us. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. A Delaware native and retired diplomat now living in Dubai has written a new book. David Rundell is among the nation's leading experts on Saudi Arabia, where he lived for 15 years. He also served as an American diplomat for 30 years in Washington, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, Syria, Tunisia, and the United Arab Emirates. Rundell recently spoke with Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele about his book, Vision or Mirage, Saudi Arabia at the Crossroads, which offers an in-depth examination of the rapidly changing socioeconomic landscape of that country.
Hey, let's give some background about yourself and how this new book, Vision or Mirage, came to be.
Well, I grew up in Delaware, and I went to university at Oxford, where I studied Arabic because I wished to join the Foreign Service. And I spent 30 years in the Foreign Service. Half of that time was in Saudi Arabia. That's unusual. And when I finished, there were a number of people who thought that I really had an obligation to write down some of what I had learned for my future colleagues. And I did that, and the book became a book of really of general interest. We tried to write it less encyclopedic and more of a general interest. So the book, which exists today, is really an effort to explain a country which is very important but also very poorly understood to the American public. And so that was the origin of the book, and so far I think it's succeeding in what we're trying to do.
Explain that last statement further that you just made. It's a country that's poorly understood, if you will. Explain more.
Well, Saudi Arabia is an extremely unusual place. It's a strange place, even you could argue a weird place. It's the last strategically important monarchy in the world. It operates, well, I used to tell the young officers in the embassy that, you know, take your political science book and throw it away. Go get a book on how Henry VIII ran Tudor England, and now you'll understand how Saudi Arabia works. Its economy is very odd because in most countries, certainly in the United States, the living standard of the people is directly related to their productivity. in Saudi Arabia, the two are divorced. The Saudis live a much higher standard of living than their productivity would entitle them to, because so much wealth just flows from the ground. There are many reasons. For example, another thing, they don't really have a monetary policy because their interest rates are set in the United States because their currency is pegged to our dollar. That's a bit complicated, but basically they don't have a monetary policy. They don't have a fiscal policy because they don't have taxes. So all of these things make it an unusual place. The flip side of that is that they have not been very welcoming to foreigners. So not only is it a difficult place to understand, it's a hard place to get to even if you want to understand it. So for those reasons, it's been a poorly understood country.
All right, so let's go into some great detail about this new book, Vision or Mirage, Saudi Arabia at the Crossroads. Tell us more.
Well, the book is, the thesis of the book is that Saudi Arabia has been more stable for many years than many people predicted. It is today perhaps, in fact, not perhaps, certainly less stable than many people presume. That matters to the rest of us. And that is the, if you will, the argument of the book is that that does matter to us. That many of the reason that it is less stable today is because it is going through very significant social and economic changes. Most of those changes are ones which we have been encouraging them to do for a long time. Most of them are things that we would consider to be moving in the right direction, the emancipation of women being the most obvious, but there are many others, the reduction of power of the religious authorities. These are things which we should encourage and should support and should want them to succeed. Economically, they're trying to diversify their economy away from oil so that they have something to do when the oil runs out. So the country is changing. We should encourage that, but we should recognize that it has made the place less stable, and we should be trying to help them. That really is the argument of the book.
How long have you been writing books, sir?
Oh, well, I've been writing political reports for 40 years. That's really what political officers do. They are essentially journalists who write articles that don't get published in the newspaper. So I've written, essays every week for most of my life. The writing the book was a little different in that it had to be structured and it was longer, and that took a couple of years to write the book.
Some things that have been said about your work. This comes from the New York Times. I wish that every member of Congress would read it before voting on any measure related to Saudi Arabia. I wish every American pondering the frictions of our long relationship with the Saudis would read it simply to understand. Do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. The Saudis have a... How would you phrase? They have a public relations problem, a very serious public relations problem, in that most of the things that you hear about them are the negative things, which are true. But there are positive things which often are overlooked. The other element which is often overlooked is just how good a partner they have been for the United States for 75 years. Of all the major countries in the Arab world, they are the only ones that stuck with us completely through the Cold War. If you look at Syria, Iraq, Egypt, Libya, all of these countries at one time or another were our opposition in the Cold War. The Saudis have always been stuck with us. They play an important role today in oil markets. We could talk about that at great length, but... We are not totally independent of what the Saudis do, and the rest of the world is certainly not independent of what the Saudis do in oil markets. And by and large, they are a responsible steward of oil markets. We can talk about that in detail if you want. But they have been very cooperative in counterterrorism. Recently, they have been promoting a much more moderate view of Islam than they did in the past. And they are a very important factor in resolving the Arab-Israeli dispute. So for many reasons, the Saudis have ways to be helpful, and they have been helpful, and we should continue the relationship. We should encourage them to change some of the negative elements of their society, and we have ways of doing that, and we should do that. But we should also recognize the positive elements of the relationship.
Former Secretary of State National Security Advisor Henry Kissinger calls your book clear-eyed and illuminating. Response to that?
I think Dr. Kissinger was correct. It's a clear-eyed and illuminating in the sense, well, I don't know if I should say it's illuminated. I certainly think it's clear-eyed in the sense that the book is balanced. There are negative things that the Saudis have done, and it doesn't attempt to gloss over those, nor does it attempt to gloss over the problems, the many problems, social, economic, and political problems that they face today. So it is a balanced assessment of our relationship with the Saudis and the achievements that the Saudis have done, as well as their shortcomings. And I think that's another element that perhaps the book is slightly different than others, and that it does recognize what the Saudis achieved over the last 50 years. They were an extremely backward, extremely poor country. I mean, you know, in 1950, there were two high schools in Saudi Arabia. You couldn't study French. You couldn't study chemistry. These were considered religiously unacceptable. Girls couldn't go to sports. There were no movie theaters. I mean, that was actually even more recently than that. That was in the 70s that they ended movie theaters. They had them for a little while. You know, this was a place that was ruled by a religious police force. The changes that have happened are really pretty spectacular. And the fact that women can drive is just really the tip of the iceberg. There are many. Women used to not be able to get a cesarean delivery without the permission of their husband or father, written permission. They couldn't travel outside the country without the written permission. They couldn't go to university or get a job even, certainly not open a business or a bank account without written permission of their guardian, which is usually their husband or their father. All that's changed now. So it's a significant so I think the book is clear-eyed in the sense that it assesses both the negative and the positive.
What do you want readers to take away from this book?
That's a good question. I think they should come away with a more balanced assessment of Saudi Arabia as a country in terms of the success and the failures they've had, and they certainly have had plenty of failures, and certainly in terms of diversifying their economy. So I would like people to have a balanced view of what the Saudis have achieved or have not achieved, and I would like them to have a more balanced view of what the Saudi-American relationship has been. It's been carried out largely at a very high level by a few senior, usually it's the president and the king. Most of our relationships with major foreign countries are well institutionalized, and it doesn't really matter who the ambassador to London is. Our relationship with Britain is pretty solid, in fact, institutionalized over many years. As I said, Saudi Arabia is the last strategically important monarchy in the world. It's a monarchy. The king makes the laws. And how the president gets along with the king makes a big difference in that relationship. And so people, I think, because it's been conducted at such a high level, the average American has a poor understanding of how that relationship really functions. And so hopefully, by reading this book, they might understand that better.
We are talking to America's leading expert on Saudi Arabia, Mr. David Rundell. As he's speaking to us from Newark, Delaware, before we even started our conversation, you were giving me some of your background. You said you have a home in Wilmington. You have a home in London, but you live mostly in Dubai. I have to ask, what is your favorite part about living in Dubai?
That's a great question. Dubai is, I've lived there pretty much since 97. On and off. The place is dramatic. I mean, it has really changed very substantially. It has grown. It has developed. It is vibrant. It is a truly multinational city. I mean, if you think of New York as being a very multinational, or London being a very multinational city, Dubai is even more cosmopolitan than that. If you go to the airport in Dubai, the places that flights are going to, I mean, you can get a flight from, Well, you can get 7 flights a day to London before COVID, but it's almost like a bus. You just go to the airport and you can get on a plane. But you can fly to Buenos Aires or Moscow or Beijing, all from the Dubai airport. It's a very interesting place in terms of the number of different kinds of people that are there. And that's reflected in what goes on in the city. All kinds of different people doing different things, different kinds of restaurants. It's a very cosmopolitan place. I think that's what makes it interesting. It certainly doesn't have the history of a London or the dramatic architecture of Washington, though it does have a lot of interesting buildings, including the tallest skyscraper in the world. So that I think that's what makes it interesting. It has a buzz to it. It's a growing and new city, and it's dynamic.
David, final words about your book, Vision or Mirage, Saudi Arabia at the Crossroads.
Well, it's Saudi Arabia is an important country. It's poorly understood. I hope that people read this book to have a better appreciation of what Saudi Arabia has become over the last 50 years and how that affects the United States and in terms of peace with the Arab-Israeli dispute and counterterrorism and a variety of other things. So I think that's the bottom line, that hopefully people will have a better understanding of that.
Thanks to David Rundell, author of Vision or Mirage, Saudi Arabia at the Crossroads, and R. Kelly Steele for their time on The Green this week. And we close out this week's edition of The Green with the latest episode of the A Matter of Facts podcast from Delaware Humanities. That's next here on The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. This week, we bring you the latest installment of the Delaware Humanities podcast, A Matter of Facts. The podcast delves into identifying trustworthy and reliable sources of news and information as part of Delaware Humanities' mission to engage, educate, and inspire all Delawareans through cultural programming. This season, the podcast more closely examines popular sources of news and information. And this episode is focused on a source or perhaps tool that is truly ubiquitous, Google. The search engine is the place so many of us begin our quest for information. In 2019, it was the most visited website in the U.S. with nearly 259 million unique visitors. And among search engines, Google has a 62.5% market share in the U.S. and an almost 88% share worldwide. So what is Google's role as an information source or tool? And more specifically, how does it shape the information we see on a day-to-day basis? To help answer those questions, we are joined on this podcast by Dr. Alexander Halavay, Associate Professor at the University of Arizona School of Social and Behavioral Sciences and author of Search Engine Society, Volumes 1 and 2. Here is the A Matter of Facts podcast. Dr. Halavay, thanks so much for joining us on the A Matter of Facts podcast.
My pleasure.
So let's start with, I guess, kind of more of a global kind of question. That is, how difficult is it at this point to kind of quantify Google's role and influence on the news and information that people get?
Pretty difficult, actually. I mean, part of the issue is that it is invisible infrastructure in a way that we really don't think about it. And so it's hard to quantify it exactly. We know that in terms of the market, in terms of the search engine market, they're extraordinarily dominant. But it's often difficult to think about just how influential they are across different media systems.
And I guess even in the period between the first volume of your book, Search Engine Society, in 2008, and the second volume in 2017, I imagine there was a pretty big shift even in that relatively small time frame in what Google was and what kind of influence it wielded.
Yeah, in fact, it's always dangerous to write in this area in technology because by the time it went to press, one of the major pieces had already changed. It had already thrown away its pledge to never do personalized search, and a lot of other little things had changed even between the time when I submitted the manuscript for the first edition and when it hit the press. So certainly over the decade, things changed. Now, in terms of the domination of that particular company, I don't know that had changed. I think it had sort of become more kudzu-like and become a little bit less visible in some ways. I think that people don't go; they still go to the search engine to the big white screen and look for things, but I don't think that happens quite as much. I think a lot of more is happening kind of under the table or behind covers. So yeah.
And piggybacking on that, can you give us a little perspective, if you can, on just how much how different people's ability to seek and find information is, just the average person, because they have search engines like Google. I mean, I guess that's what you're saying is that in some ways we probably don't even notice how big an influence it is on our ability to seek and find news and information.
Right. I mean, I guess there's a parallel here between how we use search and how we use our cell phones. I still know the phone number of my grandparents' house when I was, 6 or 7 years old. That's one of about 3 phone numbers I now know. When I was in college, I knew by heart, the number for the pizza place and a whole bunch of other numbers. But as the phone has taken over that role where we don't need to know those phone numbers by heart anymore, we kind of have lost that ability to memorize them or don't need it anymore. And I think that's happening an awful lot. I mean, I think it may just be me getting older and losing my memory, but, I think we have moved to this point where there are things that we don't really need to know at the tip of our fingers. We could always look things up, right? We could always go to the library if we'd forgotten a particular fact. This is the question of memorizing dates in history or something like that. We could always look that up before, but now we have it at our hand, over dinner, not having to remember the name of a movie or the name of or who was acting in a particular film, because we can look it up right away. And so I think that we've come to rely on that. There's this interesting question that this has come up in lots of technologies of what happens when that disappears. And it's kind of an arbitrary question, but it becomes real when, there's a fight right now in Australia and shaping up in Canada about whether they're going to allow Google to continue to operate there or whether Google will pull out of those countries. We have this, it's an interesting thought experiment. I mean, at least if what would you do if you lost Google? Like, how would that change your day-to-day behavior? I think not as much as it might have even 5 or 6 years ago, but still, we've come to rely on it as a sort of outsourced brain for us.
I was going to say, and I guess that has kind of implications, particularly when you talk about things like news. When you're talking with somebody, you're debating a point or something like that, that you can quickly look something up to back up your point or refute somebody's point. That it does make it almost instantaneous your ability to kind of build an information base that maybe you wouldn't have been able to do when you had to, back when you and I were younger, go to the library and find that information first.
Right, and I do wonder, how that affects this ability to agree to disagree, right? At some point, you do have a fact check right there in your pocket. The question is whether you actually get the facts when you do that. I'm like everybody on social media, and I do surprisingly still see things like, where did you find that piece of information? Well, it's from Google. This idea of Google as a source rather than as a tool to find a source is still sticks around, especially among the older generation, where they see the search engine as the source, and so that's problematic on one hand. But yes, you're right. You now have that access to information at your fingertips and can kind of pull that up rather than having to go find it.
Well, you mentioned the idea that it's not a source; it's a tool, and Google and other search engines out there. There is more than just Google. Can you tell us a little bit about how Google is like some of the other search engines that are out there, and what kind of separates it from the crowd? Is there a reason for that incredible market share that we talked about earlier?
Well, in one sense, it is a natural monopoly, and that's part of the invisible piece of Google. So, they've been pulled up before the U.S. Congress and asked about that monopoly status, and they say, oh, well, anyone could come forward like we did, and, in their garage right now, someone is building the Google killer. And I don't think that's quite true. At this point, it takes an enormous amount of actual electricity to crawl the Internet. A large portion of the traffic on the Internet is Google's bots going out and finding new information. That operation is tremendous in its scale. Back in 2 decades ago, when people talked about the NSA, they talked about their computing power in terms of acreage. And I think you can rather than machines, in terms of acres of computing power. And I think you're there with Google as well, that their data centers are just tremendous. And so that literal physical infrastructure is often invisible because you know, it's not in Silicon Valley, it's out in the middle of nowhere, you know, including places like Arizona. And so that piece is really difficult to kind of make up. So I think part of that dominance is that there's really only a handful of companies, Microsoft, Google, Amazon, and some you know, second and third runners that have that kind of physical infrastructure to do that with. Its initial success came from finding a way to, to get rid of porn in your search results, put it quite simply. That there were a number of search engines, all of them attempting to come up with the best way to come up with the answer you were trying to get, and the companies that were selling porn online, one of the first really successful ventures that online that actually made money, were really trying to force the hand of the search engines and make them appear more quickly and as a result of completely unrelated searches. And so Google found a way, the founders of Google found a way of looking at basically citation structures and surfacing some of the more useful, or this is the way they would put it, or more relevant search results. And so I think that gave them their initial competitive advantage, and that kind of led to this dominance. But at this stage, I really don't think it's the technology so much, although they do also have intellectual capital. They hire an enormous number of PhDs and researchers. But I think it is largely that physical infrastructure, that kind of heavy machinery that allows them to maintain that position.
You've talked a lot about this kind of invisible piece of Google, and I suppose one of the things at work here is something that we've discussed in previous episodes of this podcast. That's the role of algorithms. What can you tell us about Google's use of algorithms and the impact they have on what we see now when we search on Google?
Sure. So, I mean, that first competitive advantage was a particular algorithm called PageRank, which they patented and gave them that advantage. But Google finds what it thinks is most relevant using a large number of signals. And if you talk to people who are trying to reverse Google's algorithms, these are folks involved in search engine optimization, they will tell you they know the number, and none of them know the number. This is kind of like the seven secret ingredients or Coke's recipe, right? This is what Google banks on, is a secret way of figuring out what out there should surface and what should be buried. And so they have that ability of kind of changing the agenda on very small micro topics using this system, this algorithm that chooses what is relevant and what is irrelevant. And then, like in other systems that use algorithmic processes, often they will revert to this naturalistic argument, which is, well, we're just fine, you know, it's not, there's no influence from Google on this. It just finds the most relevant material. But that's not the case, right? Anytime we're choosing what is and what is not relevant, whether it's us or a machine, that is not a neutral process. That is not a balanced process. It is a deliberately unbalanced process. That is what we go to Google for bias. That's what we go to newspapers for. We don't want all the news. We only want the news that's fit to print. And so, we rely on Google to do that, and Google relies on the secrecy of that process to make it work and not to have it be reverse engineered by those materials.
I'm curious what Google's reach in other areas, things like, you know, Maps, Gmail, YouTube, you know, Chrome as a web browser. What impact they have on how people obtain information, what they see, and kind of shaping what they see beyond, you know, the algorithms and things like that.
Yeah, so Siva Vaidyanathan has a book called The Googleization of Everything. And Google, you know, from fairly early on said that their mission was not search. It was kind of changing information into knowledge, which is sounds like a very high, I mean, that's my goal as well, so I guess we share that. you know, so they've moved into a large number of these areas. I think it's worth noting that for all of that high-mindedness, Google is chiefly an advertising company. Right? This is how they make money. They attract people to their services, and then they sell advertisers that attention. So they're in the process. Yeah, that's how they make their money is converting attention into sales to advertisers. And so yes, they have moved into a lot of these spaces. And although, like I said, I think if we imagine Google, the search engine, disappearing, it probably would not have that large effect. If we thought a little bit about kind of the ways it has moved into a large number of areas, I think the disappearance of all of Google's services at one would be probably a fairly enormous hit on the internet as a whole. I do think that you've seen some incursion into this by companies like Facebook, but Google has kind of moved into quite a bit more than I think we imagine. And certainly the branded product. I mean, I'm surprised by the number of people who don't make the connection of Google to YouTube, despite a fairly obvious connection there. But, the front-facing Google properties like YouTube and Gmail and, for example, Docs, which have moved into Google Docs and Drive, which have moved into a lot of spaces. I think people kind of make that connection. But a lot of the stuff that undergirds this, I mean, most of the maps you see online still are powered by Google. Google has digitized and owned a huge number of books, as part of their Google Books project. So just the amount of data that they hold and the amount of data that they transfer on a given day is largely, again, I keep coming back to this, it's not intentional necessarily, but is not something that we necessarily look at and see. It happens between as business-to-business kinds of transactions, or it happens as part of the advertising that you see on a newspaper site, for example, is often powered by Google Ads. And so those kinds of things that happen beyond what we see as branded Google stuff, which is already quite a bit on the internet.
One thing that people have looked at a lot as they've researched Google and its search results is the implications on inequality and racism. What has your research found in this area of looking at Google and its effect?
Yeah, and so this especially gets back to this question of algorithms and equity, right? That a computer can't be racist is kind of this go-to knee-jerk reaction, and of course a computer can be racist when it's programmed by humans. And largely what Google does is reinscribes some of the inequities that already exist. So if you're looking at things like what websites are authoritative and what you're using as your measure of that is what other websites think are authoritative, you end up with kind of a vote that looks very much like how people in the population might consider determining authority. So that's the first step. It reinscribes writ large many of the inequities that already exist in society. And so this is the example of Microsoft's Twitter bot that started spouting racist rhetoric, and people said, what were those programmers thinking? And it really had less to do with the programmers than the fact that they were on Twitter. And anybody that is on Twitter for very long will learn from that, and learn in not a particularly nice way. So, in some ways, I think Google is a mirror, and therefore, when we see racist search results, what we're seeing is a mirror of a racist society. But there are specific cases in which it seems to not just reinscribe but deepen those kinds of reactions, and so particularly when it could be manipulated. That's one example where, for example, search results for Martin Luther King for a time, the first search result was a page that was produced by a group of white nationalists that slandered Dr. King. And so that where it's been manipulated is one example where inequality can be pushed forward and then reproduced by the search engine. But there are other examples as well. I mean, a colleague was recently noting that they were working on searching for something about Asia, and the keyword Asian had kind of fallen into a forbidden keyword in their school searches. This is at a K-12 level, and the reason is that Asian girls is usually used to look for pornography rather than looking for girls in Asia, which is just kind of this writ large problem with the way people think about the kind of race and objectification. But then it kind of gets repercussions, which is the word Asian as a bad word or a forbidden word is a significant problem.
Right.
And so when it does reinscribe those, it can really retrench them in an extreme way.
Given that and the reach that, that Google has, what do you see as its responsibility for policing these issues and things like the spread of misinformation or disinformation, fake news, those type of things?
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, if their business is creating bias, I think they have a primary responsibility to make sure that that creation of bias, of selection, of determination of what's important and what is not, is socially responsible. And so it is not, you know, I am not a technologist in that I don't build search engines, but I know enough about them to know that it is a challenge. This is an epistemic challenge as well, determining kind of, this is what journalists are dealing with, have always dealt with and are dealing with now, this question of balance versus neutrality versus objectivity versus just finding the facts, right? And so this is a question that, that frankly, a lot of folks who are trained in computer science often don't get a very good grounding in. They may have, most of them do have, you know, half a course or a course in ethics.
Right.
But this larger question of how do you determine how much you should manipulate those results, you know, aside from the, oh, that's a bad result, we should kind of get rid of that, or should we open this up to voting by others? That question of how you do that is a much more difficult one to tackle. The question of whether they should do that is an easy one, which is, yes, they have a responsibility to make sure that the mirror that they hold up does not reflect the most pernicious parts of our society and you know, to the detriment of the society as a whole.
Let's flip the script then, having talked about Google's responsibility in these kind of discussions. How about users? Are there ways for people to be more thoughtful, informed users of search engines like Google and use it to be a better consumer of information?
Yeah. So, I mean, in the same way that you would, again, I keep coming back to this, being an informed reader of news or viewer or listener of news, I think that you can be an informed searcher of the web or searcher of the internet as a whole. Part of that is some basic literacy, to be sure, of understanding a little bit about how Google works and how it determines where information is coming from. Part of it is making sure that you don't have a singular diet of a single search engine for where you're getting information. And so there are some options out there, including those that kind of pose themselves as direct options, something like DuckDuckGo. You know, the truth is that, you know, in terms of actual search results, Google still has the largest engine. So you do often surface things there that you wouldn't otherwise, but they can be very deep in those search results. So, you know, there's no reason not to go to Bing or DuckDuckGo or even something like Baidu, even though we know that there are censorship issues there. This is, Baidu is the largest search engine in China and one of the largest in the world. You know, there are certain issues with censorship there that are directly government related and also culturally related, but kind of broadening your diet is another way to make sure that you're getting a little bit of a push there. But some of this is simply not relying too heavily on Google's ability to filter these things. You know, I think that, you know, when you go to a website and you are relying on that website to do the heavy lifting of determining what's important and what's not, that's problematic. And so you need to be willing to see Google as something that is able to dig and uncover materials, but then you have to be willing to engage in those materials critically as well.
And so looking ahead a little bit, and I know you kind of you talked a little bit earlier about, so what would happen if Google disappeared, and there are some places that are looking at, you know, Google's role. What are your thoughts on where Google is headed? What might it look like in three, five, even, you know, 10 years out for people using it?
So I do think it is, you know, as we said, even over the last decade, it's kind of faded into the background. And I think it's as important as it always has been, but is continuing to do that. I think that, you know, people don't think about search in the way that they might have when search engines were new. It's no longer their first stop for looking for things. And as I said, if Google disappeared, where would I go? It turns out that strangely, although I've never, I think, searched on Facebook, that the number of searches performed on Facebook has increased to the point where it's beginning to rival Google. You know, people find information when they want more current information, when they want something immediately, they'll turn to something like Twitter. So in some ways, people are looking at different – if I'm looking for – strangely, if I'm looking for facts, I might go to Wikipedia first, as Google does in many cases. So I think that people are finding other places to find things, but also a lot of what Google does is looking at search kind of outside of that search box. So we'll continue to search, but I think Google will take up a role that is much more supportive in that process. Over the next 10 years, I think that we're moving away from what's the best website to answer a question to what's the best answer to a question. And so what I just said a minute ago will become less and less relevant as we're asking Google or Alexa or our phone to answer a question for us. In other words, we don't want you to take us to a source. We want you to give us the answer. And so I think that we've seen much quicker than I had expected, and I'm usually, I usually overestimate the ability of technology to perform. But I think more quickly than I had expected, we are seeing advances in the ways in which computers can begin to formulate answers that are much more human-like. And so I suspect that Google will be, this is one of the ways in which Google organized itself as a way of kind of sucking up all of this information. The search engine for the web was initially intended to be able to get this large corpus of material, you know, the knowledge of the web as a whole, and to try to make sense of it in a way that is more like a human, that is more like an intelligence. And I suspect Google, along with other players, will be fighting to be first in that realm and fighting to create answers that are not search results, but rather results. And that brings with it a lot of the concerns that we've already had, but to a much higher degree, I think.
And finally, we'd like to end this podcast by asking each of our guests, where do you get your news and information on a daily basis? What are your kind of favorite sources for news and information?
So it's funny because I think I've gone backwards a bit, but I am a newspaper reader. I wonder if that has shifted for a lot of people over this time, but on a daily basis, I will pick up a paper. And for a while, honestly, that was through Google News, looking for that filter, because it was catching more things. And these days, you know, like I go, and I don't want to kind of endorse, but I go to some of the major national papers. I generally do New York Times, Washington Post, and Wall Street Journal. And so I am looking to those newspapers to a degree that I haven't for a while to kind of help me with thinking about an agenda. I am moving away from Google despite it being something that I think about quite a bit.
Fascinating. Thank you so much for the conversation, Dr. Alexander Halavay, Associate Professor at the University of Arizona School of Social and Behavioral Sciences and author of Search Engine Society, Volumes 1 and 2. We really do appreciate your time and for you joining us here on the Matter of Facts podcast.
It's been fun. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to the latest edition of the A Matter of Facts podcast. The full podcast is available at DelawarePublic.org and DEHumanities.org. A Matter of Facts is brought to you by Delaware Humanities, a state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Its mission is to engage, educate, and inspire all Delawareans through cultural programming. We thank the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation for its generous support of this initiative and the Pulitzer Prizes for its partnership. A Matter of Facts is produced by Delaware Public Media. And that's all we have time for on this week's edition of The Green. The stories, interviews, and podcasts you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to the Greens page on our website. And remember, the Green can also be found via podcast at our website, on Apple Podcasts, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter, at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Support for The Green comes in part from the Delaware Alliance for Nonprofit Advancement. Dana is an advocate for nonprofits, offering strategies to strengthen leadership skills, improve board effectiveness, and enhance nonprofit sustainability. Learn more at DelawareNonprofit.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, Delaware Humanities, Sierra Fisher, and Kyle Parks, and Delaware Public Media's Sophia Schmidt and Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week here on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.